was a lonesome cowboy.
Hello, everybody. Welcome to this month's free preview of our What a Cartoon Movie episode all about Toy Story 4. I am one of your hosts, Bob Mackey, and just like Forky, I love sleeping in trash. And who's here with me today, as always?
Hey, it's Henry Gilbert, but mainly I'm just going to be a soundboard of previously recorded Don Rickles lines.
Ooh, very nice.
Hey, watch it.
Whoa. Where's my ear?
But we're kicking off the summer of Pixar, correct?
That's right.
And we're kicking it off with Toy Story 4 because previously we revisited all of the earlier Toy Story movies. So naturally, it's time to cover 4, and we're doing that in extensive detail for about 5 hours or more. And you're going to hear a little bit of the history of Toy Story 4, about 45 to minutes to an hour of it. But if you want to hear the entire thing and get access to all of our What a Cartoon movies, including all of the other Toy Story movies we've covered, head on over to patreon.com/talkingsimpsons and sign up at the $10 level. You'll get almost, 5 or 6 complete years. It's almost 5 complete years of What a Cartoon Movie. And everything we've done on the Patreon for 6 entire years. That includes all of our limited miniseries. You get regular monthly access to things like Talking Futurama and Talking of the Hill, and over 150 miniseries episodes that you haven't heard if you're not a patron at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. And Henry, what else is happening at the $10 level, the What a Cartoon Movie level for patrons?
Oh man, if you sign up now, you're going to get to hear the rest of our summer of Pixar. Next month, you're going to be hearing us talk about The Incredibles, our first non-Toy Story Pixar movie we're talking about, and continuing our adventure through the career of Brad Bird. And that back catalog covers everything from Akira to a Goofy movie, as I like to say. We've covered everything. This year alone, we've done Disney classics like Dumbo and TV movies like Batman, Superman, World's Finest, and even some live-action animation hybrids like Little Shop of Horrors, which, you know, it's like stop motion in it. It's not exactly Roger Rabbit, but if you want to hear our longest one ever, that is Who Framed Roger Rabbit, and that's 6.5 hours long. Mm-hmm. I would say over 300 hours just of What a Cartoon Movies at that $10 level, and you get all the $5 things Bob just mentioned.
And if you've never signed up for a Patreon before, it is so easy to do. And once you sign up, you can listen to our bonus podcast at any podcast app or device you might have, the same way you listen to your free podcast, or you can download the Patreon app for any smart device you might have and download our bonus podcast that way as well. But no matter which way you do it, it's so easy to access all of the bonus content waiting for you behind the Patreon paywall at patreon.com/talkingsimpsons. That's it for our sales pitch. Now get ready to hear us dig into the existential horror of Toy Story 4.
Now I got friends coming out of my ears, I'll never be lonesome again. You can't be happy when you're all by yourself. Go on, tell me I'm wrong.
So let's go back to Toy Story 3 in 2010. A huge crowd pleaser, nominated for Best Picture. Overall, a huge success for what we now call a Lega sequel. That's what it's called, right?
Oh, yeah.
So Toy Story 3 is a Lega sequel, and so is Toy Story 4, because they take 10 years off.
And it's all about introducing a new status quo with younger actors, but around the old actors that you know and love. Just like, I'm really enjoying these Scream Lega sequel series that they're doing, or requels, actually, that's what they call themselves in the movie.
Okay.
They call them requels.
Lego sequel's fun to say, though.
I like it, too.
So despite rumors, for the first handful of years after Toy Story 3, Pixar and Disney deny the existence of Toy Story 4. There are some rumors in 2013 that the fourth movie was in production and due in 2015. That's obviously not true. And I think a few voice actors might have hinted in the press that they had been approached, but as far as official announcements went, there was none at this point in time.
I mean, the animated films all take forever to do, and I would totally understand that one of the voice actors would just say, like, yeah, they extended an option for Toy Story 4, I mean, but they can record with the voice actors for 2 years before even announcing a film, for
yeah,
sure.
Yeah, absolutely. So, an official announcement is made on November 6th of 2014. Toy Story 4 is in production with a tentative release date of June 16th of 2017.
Well, we know that's not how it ended up.
And that did not happen. Let's just say there are very different people associated with this version of Toy Story 4 I'm talking about right now. Some left the project. Some weren't allowed to work on the project anymore because they had to, well, they were forced out.
Yeah, I recall the announcement of this in 2014 making me sad, because I mean, this was also at the certain low point of Pixar, because, you know, there had been all these like Cars things and Cars 3 actually isn't bad. It's my favorite Cars movie, but I still was thinking less of Pixar. And then to hear the, like, why are you going back to Toy Story? You had the perfect ending. Like, you don't need to do more of this.
Yeah, I mean, after Toy Story 3, we started to see some of the projects that were brought into creation post-merger, and they were sequels, and they were things like Brave, and there were more Cars movies. So the 2000s, especially the early 2000s, Pixar was just like, oh my God, it's so exciting, this new animation company. But then the bloom had been off the rose by 2010 after the release of Toy Story 3.
It's also crazy that Pixar had to get more into, like, the Disney's pushing more for sequels from them after buying them too, because the 2010s starts with Frozen, which is just plain old Disney feature animation making $1 trillion with a movie. And I thought that was of like, oh, you guys figured out how to make a princess movie in the classic Disney feature style that makes a shitload of money in 3D. You finally cracked the code, and you don't need to count on Pixar as much to be the $1 billion money maker, you know?
Yeah, yeah. I think they were trying, I mean, it's all part of the same company, but I think internally they were trying to outdo Pixar and have more of the prestige of Pixar.
Yeah, which, I mean, Frozen is a very good movie, as is Wreck-It Ralph is another of my favorite, like, Disney feature, and Moana's pretty good too, but to me they are not equal to the best of Pixar, I would say.
So who was attached as director to this movie? Why, none other than Big Baby himself, John Lasseter.
Oh boy, here yeah. It is. Yeah.
Well, I mean, his name is on the movie, so he's attached as director.
Well, he's like co-director on a ton of stuff for, yeah. Even not three. No, he was a co-director on 3, wasn't he? Or just an EP. I forget.
But yeah. I mean, despite this movie being released after the troubles, he has received a credit on it.
I mean, unless he signed a contract to remove his credit from stuff, I hate to defend an awful person, but creatively in Hollywood, I feel like if you get, you deserve a story by credit if you work that hard on it. You
I think it's just WGA rules. Like, he could have killed Rashida Jones with his bare hands and gotten the credit at the end of the movie. Speaking of which, Rashida Jones and Will McCormick, they're writing partners at this time. They're attached as writers. Lasseter directing this is a big deal because he hadn't directed a movie since Cars 2, which was the studio's first real critical misfire.
I mean, it was crap. It was real crap, yeah.
So I think that's why he stepped away from directing, and this is his chance to be like, the big man's returning to Toy Story once again. He's going to show everybody that he's still got it, and he's got these new hot writers on the case, so they're going to make a great Toy Story movie.
I wonder, you know, with the kernel of how early the kernel of it was, and maybe I'll learn, but when I first saw it in 2019 in theaters, I couldn't not think of Lasseter's involvement in it, especially because he's on the credits. And I feel like the kernel of the idea of Woody getting sick of his job, like he calls it a job and he's getting sick of it. I do wonder if it was a little of Lasseter feeling like, I'm getting too old for this shit. Like, can I really direct another movie?
At this point in Lasseter's life, I think he thought, I can do whatever I want whenever I want. Also, I can touch any woman I want, but I'm the king of Disney. If I want to walk over to Pixar and direct Toy Story 4, I'm doing it. Yeah. I don't think there was any, I'm going to quietly walk off into the sunset. I think he said, I am the sunset. You're all staring at me.
You're right, actually. Yeah, you're right.
You're thinking of him as a loving, caring human being with empathy for people.
I'm being too nice. Yeah. Yes. Yeah.
When I see that twisted little fucker on these documentaries where he's wearing his like cutie baby shirts, I want to throw up all over him. He makes me sick.
I hate hearing him talk about his best friend Hayao Miyazaki too.
Yeah. Yeah. It's all an act. You know it's all an act, and it makes me sick. He's a predator, and it's gross. And I don't like that he got a fucking new job.
Yeah, yeah. He at Skydance, where people are working with him that I wish weren't working with him either. Yeah, it sucks.
We won't go over the details, but he shouldn't be working anywhere, folks.
No,
that's all I'm saying.
He shouldn't. What? Why is there always a second chance just for these assholes?
Yeah, well, they made too much money for other people, so that just gives you infinite chances.
The people who never got first chances, for him to get, honestly, a fourth chance with this. Like, if you count his second chances are when these things were tried to be dealt with privately and then they never really dealt with them, like, yeah, yucko. But anyway, sorry.
So Rashida Jones and Will McCormick, they're hired to write this movie, off of the heat from their 2012 romantic comedy Celeste and Jesse Forever, which Rashida Jones also stars in. It's an indie movie. I haven't seen it, but apparently it's a very critically acclaimed romantic comedy that sort of reinvents the genre in a way. It sounds interesting, but I have not seen this movie.
No, you know, I missed it too. It sounded twee-ish to me, but I forgot this era of where this brief time where Rashida Jones was like in the Wes Anderson kind of mode, or just like, oh, you know what? She's going to be the new indie creative here. And I mean, I don't feel like she does. She doesn't do that anymore. I don't know. I don't know.
I think she's producing stuff. One thing I found out about her, and this is because I watched Clerks 3, I remember that in the early aughts and late 90s, like every Kevin Smith friend got to direct a movie, you know?
Yes.
Right. And Jeff Anderson, Randall himself, directed a movie called Now You Know, and it stars Rashida Jones. So at one point in her career, Rashida Jones was directed by Randall.
That's insane.
This was 2002. That Randall was higher on the food chain than Rashida Jones.
But she's the daughter of Quincy Jones.
Hey, you got to start somewhere, and sometimes Randall's going to be your director.
That's insane.
You know what your problem is, Rashida?
I forgot she co-wrote that Tag movie that was based... I'm looking things up here, but yeah. The Angie Tribeca thing, that was her TBS comedy, Angie Tribeca.
Friends have told me that's a very funny Police Squad style show. I think I hold it against Rashida Jones that she played one of the worst characters ever on television in Parks and Rec, and that she was nobody.
She was nobody and nothing.
She was like, there was a Parks and Rec RPG, you'd be playing her.
You're right, yeah. Yeah, no, I like her just fine. I think she's a good actress. I think she's funny. But yes, her character didn't need to exist in it. I barely even forgot the character's name. That's why they write her off in that last season, too.
So with this early announcement, there's no hint as to what the story will be other than a love story, which is why Jones and McCormick are hired. So throughout all of this coverage, you get the sense that Pixar thinks the public may think this is another Toy Story movie that will be a cheap cash-in. So there's lots of messaging about how they're making this movie from a place of love, how they wouldn't make it if they didn't have a good idea, and so on. And also that the story was thought up by the Pixar brain trust, which is Andrew Stanton, Lee Unkrich, John Lasseter, and Pete Docter. So it's like, we're making this movie for a reason, and all of the key Pixar guys brought their ideas to the table, and they're all good ideas, and that's why we're making the movie.
They, one thing Lasseter's exit really killed was the promotion of that brain trust. Like, that was, I believe the brain trust to be like an actual important thing. It's not just fake, but it became a huge promotional tool. I've mentioned it many times, but that WALL-E trailer that was about, we had a lunch, and at that lunch, we came up with Toy Story, Finding Nemo, Monsters, Inc., and one other movie, and this is that movie,
and then
WALL-E.
No more good movies after that. We're sorry.
Well, because Joe Ranf died also. Like,
yeah,
these.
Yeah.
But yeah, they talk of this story group. I think, you know, now Pixar is in a very different place, but they're going to have to be after this. But yes, that I remember that now, that they were really saying, like, this is a real one. We did it with this real story group. So the people you liked who did Toy Story 3, this is them doing this. Yeah.
So that was a justification up front. So it's important to note that while Toy Story 3 was in production, Pixar's Andrew Stanton wrote an outline for Toy Story 4 that he kept to himself. Andrew Stanton is like the second in command in terms of Toy Story movies. He's a writer on all of them. He didn't direct any of them, but he like was a big figure in all of them. So according to the director of Toy Story 4, Josh Cooley, this is him talking about the outline Stanton wrote on his own behind the scenes. Quote, it had Bo returning. That was pretty much it. It wasn't until after you work on it for a while that you start to understand this is what the movie's telling me it should be. And that's also me in the movie as well. So it's not like Andrew sat down and said, I'm going to tell a story about being an empty nester. He just sat down and said, what if Bo Peep came back? That was it. Andrew Stanton, his kids had grown up and they had gone to college, and he wrote this outline and then realized after the fact, like, oh, this is about me and me losing my children to the adult world.
That's so interesting how they've come to that conclusion only after you start writing it. But yeah, I mean, it's clear to see in the movie that it is like, Woody watched his son grow up, and now he's kind of like, I got to raise another kid. I'm old. I'm tired of this. And he has to like double raise kids because he's got to raise Bonnie and Forky at the same time. But, you know, in Wreck-It Ralph 2, a movie I do like, my least favorite part of it is the extreme. It's so much more on the nose than even this movie, of just like, a father said his daughter is going off to college kind of feeling.
Get over it, parents.
Boo-hoo, you raised him for 18 years and now they're leaving you. Oh, I'm sure that's real sad.
My parents were happy when I left.
When you're 18, you're out the door, as Homer says.
So yeah, so behind the scenes, Andrew had a story idea in mind for Toy Story 4. He kept it to himself until the movie was over, so... This had been in the works, at least internally, for a while.
And I mean, it was a huge thing that they lose Bo Peep in Toy Story 3. They just use it as a thing to make Woody sad, like to make him extra sad. Like, well, we've lost a lot of people, including Bo. But I definitely remember this was the style at the time in 2010 and onward. Say like, oh, so the most major female toy from the first movie, she doesn't even get to be in Toy Story 3. Whatever happened to her? Like, I think it was a smart thing that Stanton even early was like, we got to do something with Bo. We can't just write her out of the series.
That's why the first thing you see in this movie addresses what happens. Mm-hmm. And so in 2015, we start to get more news about Toy Story 4. Despite how it was announced as a continuation of the original trilogy, by March of 2015, they're starting to say it's going to be its own thing outside of the original trilogy. So they're getting the audience ready for a new approach. And a lot of new characters.
And a shift. Big shift, yeah.
And so Josh Cooley is announced to be co-director alongside John Lasseter. So there's going to be not just Lasseter, but this guy named Josh Cooley. We'll go over him soon. He'd been at Pixar for a very long time at that point.
I mean, Lasseter had too many jobs. You can't... Being a director on a film, if you're doing it right, is a full-time job. You can't also have the executive-level job he had... That also involved a ton of park stuff too. Like, yeah,
I think it was head of Disney Feature Animation, Pixar, and the parks. So just three, just kingly roles for him, yeah. Right?
Again, in listing all those things, I'm like, how you fucking asshole, you blew it. You had the position to make this so much better than the empty suits who take these jobs like Bob Chapek, and you fucked it up because you're a gross sociopath.
Yeah, don't like
that.
Him.
Yeah.
So in July of 2017, John Lasseter announces he's stepping down from Toy Story 4 at D23, but not for the reasons he would step down later that year from everything entirely. So he's simply too busy before to work on Toy Story 4. He's the king of Disney, and then Josh Cooley, new to directing a Pixar in terms of features, he is given the sole role of director.
It's a great chance to give somebody. Like, that's what they should be doing. Let the Forkies of Pixar finally get a chance to direct.
Yeah. And if you want to know the Lasseter timeline, here it is. His six-month leave of absence was announced in November of 2017, and his departure from Disney was announced in June of 2018, and he remained at the company through the end of 2018 as a consultant. And if you want to know what he did, there's a lot of articles. He was a real problem to the point where they had protocol for what to do when John Lasseter enters the room. Not just like, be respectful to the boss, but like, here's how to stay away from him if you're a woman. That's not what you want at your office, and I feel like there's a lot of NDAs that were signed that are preventing some real ugly shit from coming out.
Yeah, the small amounts we know is what got leaked out of, like, Disney holds a tight ship. They don't like that stuff coming out because it does make them look pretty bad that they let it go on that long.
I mean, as soon as the stuff with Roiland went down, people on the show said, I can't say anything. I literally cannot say anything. So you have to wonder what is being silenced here.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, and the stories we heard with Roiland was even more... The protocols taken with him was just like, well, he'll get the money like he's executive producer, but he's a voice actor who never leaves his home. Like, that's what he's going to be. No, I mean, all we already know about Lasseter is bad enough, but you should always assume that if somebody gets fired on these things and you are wondering why they got fired, like, you, I think you are safe in assuming there's 10 times worse stuff that you'll never learn about it. Like, there's, instead, I hate that people, obviously they're assholes online who do this anyway, but then they make the assumption of, I bet it was just trumped up charges. One woman lied about him to get him fired. And I feel like history has shown it is almost always the opposite of, like, no, it's not one story they got built up too much. It was 500 stories and you heard three.
Yeah. It's just like, not to dwell on the Roiland stuff, but the biggest thing with him was thrown out of court or whatever. And then he returned to Twitter saying, "Ha, I was right. You all tried to destroy me." But he also didn't address the 500 other allegations, you know, like,
no,
were all those
yeah.
were all those also proven false, or are you going to not get back to me on that one?
And also, I think we've heard enough of, like, well, yeah, there's a difference between what can be actually criminally prosecuted against somebody in, you know, in the courts versus what, you know, we know happened. And yeah, on the Roiland thing, his statement did not sound like a guilty party. It sounded like a guy who says, "Guess I saw who my real friends are in this moment. Well, I'm not going to forget this." Like, it
yeah.
felt, the spirit of it felt like a guy who's not apologizing for anything.
It was a real fake friends and haters speech.
I mean, Lasseter's very PR-driven apology, as I recall, was just like, "I'm sorry if this may have offended people. I only meant this in a friendly way." Blah, that kind of thing.
It was him playing the baby man once again.
As always, like, yeah, fuck him, man.
Yeah. So yeah, he leaves, he takes his leave of absence in November 2017. And by no coincidence, this is when Rashida Jones and Will McCormick leave the project. Here's their statement to the New York Times, quote, "We did not leave Pixar because of unwanted advances. We parted ways because of creative and, more importantly, philosophical differences." And they went on to say, Pixar has, quote, "a culture where women and people of color do not have an equal voice. Even if you're a very wealthy and famous person of color like Rashida Jones."
Yeah, who she's thanks to in part by being a Nepo baby.
Absolutely.
But these are the good things Nepo babies can do that they like. Also, for example, Ronan Farrow, who also is a Nepo baby, but he used his access to at least share with people like, "Hey, this is the horrible stuff that happens in Hollywood, and I'm breaking the code of silence." This is not to that extent, but Rashida does have the position of, like, "I can at least say these things and I don't have to be scared because
yeah.
I'm very established." But we'll talk about it a ton later this summer, but I absolutely feel that a lot of the promotional materials for Turning Red were a response to statements like that from Rashida, that it was... like, the documentary about the making of is, they never mention Lasseter or that statement, but it is entirely about looking at all the women and people of color in managerial positions, and they are having so much fun making this movie. And I definitely believe they had fun making the movie, but I can't not view it as Disney trying to make a response to this.
Pixar says, "Will we put that movie in theaters?" Of course not. No. You can watch their movie for free on Disney Plus.
Now, Lightyear, that's a movie for theaters.
All made by white men.
But I have been thinking about that quote from Rashida for the longest time. Like,
yeah.
It really shattered the a vision of what people had. Lasseter more so, but even without Lasseter, her saying that, you're like, wait, I thought Pixar, they're based in the Bay Area. They're supposed to be, like, really diverse and progressive.
It really tarnished their reputation as, you know, the dream factory, when in the same month he steps down and Rashida Jones and her partner leaves the project. And I think the news was reporting on it like, Rashida Jones is leaving Pixar possibly because she was harassed. We can't tell at this moment. It's sort of like Kent Brockman reporting, but I have to assume John Lasseter was weird with her. She's a beautiful woman. There's no way he wasn't weird with Rashida Jones.
How does he, I mean, yeah, I can't imagine in a private meeting with Rashida Jones that he wouldn't be creepy with her, and certainly not treating her like an equal creatively in a meeting. Like, I would think he was probably, when she says a philosophical difference, that was her saying, and it comes from the top down, these opportunities and move up, like, it is the old white guy group. Like, and, you know, there's some good old white guys, like Andrew Stanton, like, he has a good position, but you also end up with, you get the feeling that Lasseter only promoted his buddies who are just also guys like him. And
who'd protect him, too.
Who, yes, that's a big part of it, too. Yeah, who wouldn't? This also talk about another animation asshole. But John Kricfalusi, in the big article of all the details, they got quotes from people who were attesting, like, yes, I was in the studio with when he was bringing in his 16-year-old girlfriend victim into this place. But even those guys would say, but man, Kricfalusi gave me my start, you know, he actually was a really, like, even those guys had to fucking compliment this, like, monster, and these guys feel indebted to these people.
Yeah, and it's also probably fear of reprisal if they speak out against a powerful guy in entertainment, too.
Yeah, when Lasseter, much more powerful than John Kricfalusi.
Yeah, even at the height of Ren and Stimpy. Yeah.
And even though, and they're also from the same generation and we're all in the same, they, I'm sure if we could time travel back to Burbank parties of 1987, they're in the same parties being gross mm-hmm. at the same time.
Absolutely. Yeah. So I could not find any traces of the script that, or scripts that Jones and McCormick wrote, but I did find a 2013 script by former Daily Show head writer and Colbert Report co-creator Ben Carlin that surfaced in 2019. People found it in an auction. It appears to be real. So I assume that many cracks were taken at the Toy Story 3 somehow Bo has returned movie. and this is one of them that has surfaced. So a brief summary, you can read it online, but yes, it's about Bo Peep. And in his new home with Bonnie, Woody sees a TV auction featuring his lost love. And this movie takes place right after the events of Toy Story 3, by the way. So there's a lesser Sid in the movie who's a cousin of Bonnie's that she donates her old toys to, including Woody and Buzz. And a lot of the movie features Buzz and Woody having their head on each other's body. So the Sid-like kid transplants their heads on to each other's bodies. So they're not even having their own bodies for most of the movie. And it really affects Woody.
He's
getting weird messages from Starfleet Command in his head and things like that. It sounds really silly. And the rest of the movie is about liberating Bo Peep from the pawn shop she ends up in, and then the home of her new owner who eventually buys her, because apparently this home is a bad place for a fragile toy like her. And in the movie, instead of being liberated from being abandoned and given away, Bo is bitter about it. She's not liberated. She's just bitter about the idea of being a toy, and I think Woody has to get through to her and let her know her mission in life, when the movie that we have in the end is like kind of rejecting that.
Yeah, I'm glad they didn't go with that way, because I love that Bo is more emotionally mature than Woody in this. Like, that I could not see the Lasseter stuff in this too, or just a general response to office culture in the of Pixar in this movie, because there are many scenes where Woody has to listen to a woman, that a woman tells Woody, Woody, no, we're not going to do that. Like, Dolly does that at the start. She's like, yeah, that's good, Woody. You're over there. I'm kind of in charge here. And same with, like, Bo has to tell him, no, Woody, I'm making the plan. You're part of my plan. I'm not part of your plan.
And Ducky and Bunny are also in this movie, although they are not carnival toys. They're behind the kid's dresser, basically.
Okay. Yeah. I mean, they're a fun pair of dudes. And conceptually, I like two cute toys that are sewn together. So they have to act together with one arm attached to the other.
It's some fun shtick. So, yeah, that's this guy's version of the movie. Who knows how many other versions of this movie that were written? I assume there are dozens. I assume, like, word went out through agents, write a Toy Story 3 movie. Here is the Andrew Stanton outline. Make your movie. And then people are sending scripts in, and eventually one gets made. And this is not one of them.
No, yeah, I would bet he was that man's script is one of dozens that got made, to let alone with first or the multiple drafts from one writer that Disney's going to ask for.
And, you know, we're talking about how in this version that was not made, Bo is bitter about the identity of a toy, but in the movie that we see, she's liberated. When I saw this movie for the first time, and I still think this movie is kind of about religion, where the toys have a religion based on the worship of an owner, but it drives them all insane, and eventually their God will forsake them. And Bo is trying to make Woody be a toy paganist, basically. Like, we have free-floating kids we can worship. We don't have to tie our identity to one child whose name is on our foot.
It's not as safe, but my first thought on it was, like, this is about how it's a job and how it's like, well, you should just go freelance, or, you know, just because you have this job, you're not.
Is this this is like the movie Who Moved My Cheese? The version
honestly,
of that book?
That floats around a lot.
You weren't laid off. They just moved your cheese.
Yeah. So I do think it's a little bit about being a job. Like, I mean, Woody calls his thing, what he being with a kid, a job. But yes, the way they look to their humans, and they're just like, and they have to break the rules of what they're doing with their humans a bit in this. Like, it definitely is a lot more combative with the idea of the God in their life that gives them life. Like,
And we see the creation of life in this movie, too.
They could have engaged with it even more if they wanted to.
I think that's why Forky becomes a MacGuffin after the first act, because it raises too many questions about the cosmology of this world.
And that the last spoken joke in the movie is they're saying to you, like, yeah, we're not talking about that. We'll ask the question, we're not talking
why
about
Woody
it.
Why don't Woody and Buzz and the rest create their own toys to overthrow the humans?
Exactly. It seems like they could actually drive humans insane because their words are heard by them. They speak them and can be heard.
I'm saying it. Make a Toy Story horror movie. It's got to happen. It'd be awesome.
That could be Toy Story 5 easily. Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah.
So Stephanie Folsom, who we'll cover soon, is hired as a new writer. And according to Annie Potts in a 2018 interview with the Radio Times, Folsom and Andrew Stanton rewrote most of the script that Annie had originally recorded. So this is what Annie Potts said, quote, this is from 2018, by the way. Quote, Toy Story 4 was supposed to come out this year, and then they threw out 3/4 of it and rewrote. Usually it takes from start to finish 2 years, but because they threw most of it in the bin and started over, my time on the project has been extended a little bit. I've done a lot of work on it.
That's so interesting. Wow, man. I would guess, yeah, you're going to have to re-record a whole lot of stuff. It's relatively easy compared to being in real stuff, but... live action.
This fake movie.
But compared to live action, but... I mean, speaking of which, like, boy, am I glad they didn't recast her. Like, this.
Yeah.
Yeah. It feels akin to when any older, and by old I mean over 40, actress comes back into movies, and you go, like when I see Molly Shannon in something, I go, like, why did we stop putting Molly Shannon in stuff? She's great. Or Laura Linney, that's a big one, too, where you see her and stuff, and you're like, wait, why is she? And
what about Tin Cups Rene Russo?
Yes. And you know what? In many of those cases I just named, it takes a gay male filmmaker to go like, oh, I want to put them back in stuff. I'm going to have Mike White is bi, but on White Lotus in the first season, Molly Shannon shows up. It's like, yeah, Molly Shannon. I love her.
I miss her. The movie was delayed a bunch. At some point, it swapped release dates with The Incredibles 2 because that was actually ahead of schedule. So Incredibles 2 moved to 2018, Toy Story 2 moved to 2019, and this happened in 2016, so it was before the Lasseter stuff went public.
Man.
And you know what? Incredibles 2, I was like, did anyone see that movie? A lot of people saw that movie. Currently, it is the number 4th highest grossing animated movie of all time.
I am still
Can you believe this shit?
Because I was looking that up because I was like, okay, how much does Mario movie have to make to surpass it? Because at the time of this recording, I believe it is very nearly at $1 billion, and $1 billion gets you in the top 10.
It's in the top 10 now.
So it is in the
top 10. As of this recording, you're going to hear this podcast a month after we record it, by the way. So
though it honestly should be one higher because I hate that 2019 Lion King is number one.
Will beat it.
They marketed as live action though, and then now in that list on Wikipedia. But anyway, yeah, with Incredibles 2, I saw it in theaters, I enjoyed it, and I never thought about it again. And then I look at that, like, it made more money than almost any Pixar movie ever has. Like, it's insane.
No, it's made more money than every Pixar movie.
Wow.
Because it's number 4 in the top 3 are Disney movies.
Wow.
Yeah.
I cannot get over that. That's insane.
I really think it was released in 2018 just before the MCU came to what I view as its end with Endgame.
Yeah, with the Endgame. Yeah, I guess it came out in between Infinity War and Endgame, so everybody was at the fever pitch of like, I need to see superheroes.
There was a real hunger. I mean, knock me over with a feather. I did not believe this until I saw the numbers. And Griffin Newman even referenced this on a podcast. People thought it'd be a sleeper hit. It was a huge success.
I can't believe it. And I love Incredibles, as I'm sure we'll talk about more someday, but I could not believe Incredibles 2 because it felt like it came 15 years later than it should have. Like, it felt too 10 years later than it should have. It felt too late for the sequel, and I was dead wrong. And also, I didn't even think it was that good of like a return viewing thing because it did, which I'm so glad they kind of undercut this in this movie. By the time Incredibles 2 came out, I'm not going to spoil it, but everybody at that point was already saying, well, we know that Pixar has a fake out villain. If you see a nice guy in the movie, they're actually the villain. And they sort of dealt with that, I think, in a sort of clever way in Incredibles 2. But in this movie, I think they deal with it much better with old Gabby.
You know what? I don't like her. I don't like her character, and I think it was problem with the daycare. What's the bear?
Lotso.
There you go. Lotso hugging. Uh-oh. Well, yeah. I feel like, again, too similar to other toy tragic backstories.
Yeah.
And are you? Oh, hey, Pixar movie. This person showing me around the new world. They're the villain. Are you kidding me?
Well, what I like is that Gabby Gabby's a villain within like 2 minutes instead of like 30 minutes later reveal.
We'll talk about it. So let's talk about a Toy Story 4's talent. We're only covering people that we didn't cover on previous podcasts, by the way. So the director is Josh Cooley, who is a Berkeley boy born in our fair city in 1979. Ooh. So he is in our generation, roughly. The eldest of the millennials. He's barely Gen X. He went to art school to study 2D animation. And before he left, he fell in love with storyboarding. And he was recruited by Pixar legend Joe Ramft himself. And is a true success story because he started off as a mere intern and rose to the rank of directing Toy Story 4.
Holy cow. That is, it doesn't get more success story than that in the Pixar machine, man.
And yes, he began as an uncredited story artist on The Incredibles and then received credit as a story artist on Cars, Ratatouille, and Up. And then he was made story supervisor on Cars 2. And then with Inside Out, he shared the screenplay credit with two other writers, including director Pete Docter. And from there, he was credited as being part of the Pixar senior creative team on The Incredibles 2 and Coco. And then he directed Toy Story 4, the only feature for Pixar. And it will be his only feature for Pixar because he's gone. And he is now going to be directing the second Transformers animated movie.
Which was marketed in the press releases as the first. Looking, how could they forget about it? We just did a whole podcast last year on it.
I can't believe it. But as a guy, he's born in 79. I'm sure he is going nuts to direct this Transformers movie. It feels like he's in the perfect age demographic to be in love with Transformers.
I was slightly too young to love the Transformers movie in the way I did. He is the exact age to have been in the theater and crying when Optimus Prime dies. I wonder how much he will creatively get to doing that, because, I mean, he's doing it for E1, which is Hasbro's like internal like it's the Marvel Studios of Hasbro is E1.
That's so weird, but yeah. I guess it exists.
I mean, after you make a bunch of Transformers movies that make $1 trillion, you go like, we should just have a studio internally at Hasbro.
So yeah, he left the studio in March of 2020, and after that he was associated with three projects, one of which is that Transformers movie. The other one is with Sony, a live-action adaptation of the kids' book Melamandar, and for Universal, a thing called Little Monsters, starring the Universal Monsters characters. I feel like those two aren't happening, at least not with him, and he is now going to just direct that Transformers movie. I don't think he's doing the other ones as well.
How many times is Universal going to whiff on trying to make a new Universal Monsters thing? Like, every time. Gotta
see that Tom Cruise mummy. See how that worked out.
God. Someday we're going to see that dark universe. It'll be worth the wait.
Screenplay on this is by Andrew Stanton and Stephanie Folsom. So Stephanie Folsom, let's talk about her. So she stepped in after Rashida Jones and Will McCormick left the project. This is her first real feature credit with a big asterisk, because before this, she was mostly known for being denied a story credit on Thor Ragnarok by the WGA due to guild regulations. Marvel actually intended to give her the story credit, but the WGA blocked it. And the answer to why is, according to The Hollywood Reporter, quote, in order to heighten the importance of credit and reduce the perception that screenwriters can be plugged in like spark plugs, the WGA's own members have adopted rules that limit the story-by-screen credit to two writers or teams, and that guarantee at least shared story-by credit to the first writer or team on an original screenplay. So if you come in much later, you are not given credit, because it's emphasizing the value of writers.
I don't want to be anti-WGA at this moment, but I mean, I feel that it is unfortunate for her to lose a credit because of that very well-reasoned argument for not wanting to have like 800 names on a story by credit, because it's like, oh, how many people wrote this story, you know? But it's really too bad that takes away a big credit from her. But I guess if she can at least market herself, you know, in meetings as, well, look, it's not on the credits, but you ask Marvel, I was a major writer on Thor Ragnarok.
Yeah.
Which, you know, honestly, Love and Thunder could have used her on it, writing on it, I think.
You needed many a doctor.
Yeah.
But I assume this has happened a ton in Hollywood, especially with big movies where they just throw a million screenwriters at it and they all carve away different elements of the screenplay until they have a movie that's just been overwritten.
For sure, yeah. Well, and also, you know, we've all heard about the rewrite things that happen on animated movies, especially of like, hey, let's get Patton Oswalt and Dan Harmon or whoever in here for a very highly paid day of work, and they just pitch an off-screen line.
What can character shout off-screen?
This movie has maybe a little too much of that for a Pixar movie. There's some DreamWorksy parts to this Pixar movie.
So Folsom is also known for her 2013 Blacklist script, and that is called 1969 A Space Odyssey, or How Kubrick Learned to Stop Worrying and Land on the Moon. And that is an alternate history story of a publicist who convinces filmmaker Stanley Kubrick to work with NASA to fake the moon landing. And it's a Blacklist script because the Blacklist is an annual list of most liked unproduced screenplays voted for by over 500 film industry executives. It's funny, when a lot of these are made, they're actually really bad movies.
Like Let's Go to Prison.
That's one of them?
I believe it was, okay. Yeah.
I know that Chris Pratt movie Passengers, where he wakes up a woman in cold sleep, and it's supposed to be romantic, but it's extremely creepy because he ruins her life.
Nobody mentioned the, like, well, isn't this sort of like date rape? Like, nobody said that until the movie came out.
Yeah, no one thought to question it.
This is why you need women in writer's rooms, baby, to say these things, despite what John Lasseter wants.
Yeah.
That Let's Go to Prison, I feel like it was that it was written by Robert Ben Grant and Tom Lennon. It was one of their big scripts that got them jobs, like working on Herbie. The Herbie franchise. It's all in their book. If you want to read a fun book about what it's like to be a screenwriter in Hollywood who accepts that you want a big paycheck to write something that you're not that passionate about, that's very honest, that's a very good book. The Grant and Lennon book on screenwriting.
I'm actually on the Wikipedia page for the Blacklist scripts. A lot of them get made, and a lot of them are not good movies. One of the scripts was Oz the Great and Powerful.
Ooh, that really should not have been made. That movie sucks.
Poor Evil Dead guy. Why can't I think of his name?
Sam Raimi.
Thank you.
No.
Saving Mr. Banks? I mean, I feel like these all started as better scripts than the movies they were made into, right?
Oh, Saving Mr. Banks sucks. Too. Yeah, no, I remember correctly, the Let's Go to Prison was written by Grant and Lennon, and it was their the film they thought would never be produced. Yes, they figured it was too filthy to do so, and I think an entire chapter of Odenkirk's memoir is apologizing for making that movie.
Yes, not so much the Brother Solomon, which he doesn't say a lot about.
Yeah, it, you know, that one I should give a watch to. I love Will Forte and Bill Hader. Yeah, yeah.
So she became part of the Disney factory by joining on this movie, because before this movie is released, she's credited with writing 2 episodes of Star Wars Resistance. And then I believe it looks like she moved to Amazon because she's credited with one episode of Rings of Power. That is the Lord of the Rings show. And then she is the creator of the Amazon show Paper Girls, based on the comic. And it was canceled.
Got one damn season.
Yeah, one season, 8 episodes. So, I'm sure she's got a big career ahead of her because she started it with writing Toy Story 4. But you can see she went from Disney to Amazon, and who knows where she's going next.
You know, friggin', we all in our childhood remember the Arrested Development got, you know, 3 seasons.
Our childhood?
Teen years.
I was in my, so were you? You're in your 20s.
Okay, wait, you're to our 20s. The point is, 20 years ago, wow, Fox isn't giving Arrested Development any chances when they renewed it for 2 new seasons. Like, no show gets a second season anymore, it feels like. You have to be the biggest show in the world to get a second season.
It has 10 episodes. If you don't watch it in the first weekend, it won't get renewed.
It's dead. Wasn't that what the kids in the hall were begging us to do when their new season
And
came
I
out?
Did, and I want news, because that was so funny.
Yeah, but it seems like Amazon Prime doesn't want to... There was a great Hollywood Reporter article about what a mess Amazon Prime is as a studio.
I feel like it's ignored. There's a lot of great stuff on there, but they have a terrible interface, and that it's just the Amazon interface.
And they're spending, like, there's a Russo Brothers show they're making that is making half as many episodes. They reshot the entire thing. They basically had to pay the actors for 2 seasons worth of stuff. Like, it's like a $500 million show. And on, at least with the Lord of the Rings, you're like, oh, that's a big bet to make, but it is Lord of the Rings. This is a new thing and the Russo brothers with new things has not been doing that great.
Hey, they're saying, who needs writers anymore? What if you can make your own AI movie where you're making out with your Marilyn Monroe bot?
God, it's, The Russo brothers, Marvel is worse without them, and they're worse without Marvel. They should have just stayed together forever.
I feel so betrayed because I remember it being cool, like, hey, you know the Arrested Development guys and the Community director guys? They're making a Marvel movie, and I was like, you know what? Good for them. And now they've just become gods.
That's what happens when you make the highest grossing film of all time, I guess. But it sucks, too. Yeah, this is such a tangent. But the Russos, when they did their first interviews about their Marvel movies, they said everything me as a Marvel freak wanted to hear. They referenced all the right comics. They were saying like, oh, well, you remember this moment from a comic. We turned that into this in the movie. And I'm like, when I was in the theaters, I remember that moment from the comic. And I knew you guys took it from the right thing. So it makes me so sad that where they're at right now.
We need to bust them back down to sitcoms.
They need to lose some of that confidence. Yes, they need to have a big, maybe this Prime show will fail so hard that they'll finally get some humility back.
I will say Amazon Prime, looking forward to their Fallout show.
That sounds pretty good. Yeah. And I'm going to, I've only watched a little of it. I'm going to watch some more. I did like The Boys and their Invincible TV show.
Oh, I've heard those are both good. And they're superhero things that I might like.
Yeah. Oh, you would love I think you'd really enjoy The Boys.
I think my wife has seen both of them and she does like them. And I'm sure she'll tell me on this podcast if she did, if I'm making that up.
I forgot. That's why me and my husband watched the first season of The Boys was
Nina.
Nina was the final push of like, no, seriously, watch this. Because I read The Boys comics and I thought they were okay. But people like Nina were telling me, no, this is way better than the comic. They improved on it a bit. So, anyways.
I will watch it eventually.
I can't let you throw yourself away. Don't you want to see the sun come up each morning?